Well, we are approaching the end of 2 Thessalonians, the last chapter. In general, could be called a closing directives or exhortations, though there are a lot of things here that aren't exhortations. But we noticed the first couple of verses, Paul makes a request for a prayer, and then there's an expressed confidence. Actually, the confidence is actually in the Lord, but it's Lord, the believers at Thessalonica through the Lord. And then the biggest section is we looked at last week, 6 through 12, is concerning those that, I think the New American Standard says, unruly or the undisciplined, those that aren't working. Not that they're unemployed due to lack of jobs or reception or no skills or health issues, but unemployed because they've chosen not to work. It doesn't really tell us why they're not working. We might, given the nature of 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, a lot with the eschatological questions, if we're going to make a guess, I think the guess would be that a belief that the Lord's return is very imminent, so there's no reason to work. Just quit working. However, they don't seem to have a problem with taking handouts from those that are working, even though the Lord's return is very imminent. So, Paul's general maxim is if you don't work, don't eat. And so he addressed that. In this last few verses, starting with verse 13 and following, 13 to 15 is really kind of instructions to the faithful members. Verse 13 is an appeal to continue in the path of well-doing. It says, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good." So this is in contrast, "but as for you," in contrast to those that have stopped working. And here it says, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good." Two general things here. One must be on guard against the temptation to become weary. That is, to lose courage, to falter, or give up. There's just that part that if we're not careful, we may just quit doing good. The well-doing denotes that which is right and noble, honorable and upright. So here it says, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good. And so we really need to be aware of that. Have we grown weary of good, doing good? So there's twofold. One is obviously there's that sense of to do good. And here it's not so much like a specific action, but it's that something that's high and noble and right and noble, honorable and upright. But also, that you can grow weary of that. What would be, the passage surely doesn't talk to us, explain it to us, but what do you think would be issues, that one might cause one to grow weary of doing good?
Well, it's sometimes harder than not doing good. I mean, the actively doing good takes effort. And
so there's a, just a physical, mental, a task aspect. I mean, it's effort. Okay.
Now I'm not so afraid of saying what I have to say because he revealed part of himself. Criticism.
Okay.
Or lack of appreciation.
I was thinking another line. After this week, there's been so much that I've come across that has just reminded me that sometimes the awe of God, the awe and the privilege of being able to obey God, be a child of God, be in His plan even. I think if we remembered that, it wouldn't be so weird.
Okay. So if you put even those three probably go together because of where the focus is. So, you know, when people are critical, when people are abusive, you know, the focus is very much shifted to them and self as opposed to, you know, to God. And I don't know. You have a lot of phrases that get thrown around, you know, it's like, what do they mean at times and everything, but one term is burnout, and technically from my understanding, from what I've read, burnout is not really, even though it can be used in various places, burnout's not something that somebody typically it's not an appropriate phrase for somebody in most professions. So for David, building things, even though it involves working with people, technically you don't burn out. Now, there may be other phrases that, there may be things I get all tired, but, burnout has to do, now, when he comes on Sunday and he's, leading music and stuff, burnout has to do with service and people service. So if you're involved in people service, so there's professions outside of church that can be, with the idea of burnout. And so that would be, that sense of even when things are positive, one can become overwhelmed. But normally being overwhelmed doesn't happen just because things are positive. Just because you're doing too much of it. It's usually when those criticisms, the conflicts, it just wears and wears and wears on one. I'd heard of burnout kind of defined, kind of in the area of almost like, burning a candle at both ends, just being so involved. Just always involved and never taking a break, what's the phrase that was so popular for a while? I mean, as phrases go through, it's not workaholics, but it was something like that. I forgot what it is, but there was a phrase back in probably the 80s, early 80s that got real popular. That type of phrase. And a psychiatrist professor at Dallas Seminary was asked to write a book on this topic, and it was like 3 years, and when they asked him, it would be 3 years before he could do it because he had so many commitments. And it was that type of thing, and part of it, when you go, the things like when you go on a vacation, do you take work with you? Can you ever just relax? This is kind of it. It was these things, just working all the time. Well, when I looked at things like that, and so for me, the idea of burnout was, that was whatever issues I was dealing with, it clearly wasn't burnout because those weren't issues. Those weren't things that described me. I didn't have a problem with going and doing something I enjoyed or leaving things alone. And then when I was at Fuller in a class that, actually Rob and I both took this one class in my D-Men program, and it was on the pastor's well-being or something, I forget the name of the course, but in this one book was written in this kind of a little test kind of thing on it, had to do with burnout, and I was kind of off the chart and on burnout. Because it wasn't, it wasn't focusing on this aspect of, like workaholic, but it's burnout, and there's a difference, and when you get into, but it gets into these areas of, criticisms, and that, and I'm not sure that I've ever really recovered from that part of South Dakota, and I'm not sure that this, you know, that I don't have some of this. This could be a very convicting verse, you know. Except this one says, do not grow weary. I need one that says, now that you've grown weary, here's the three steps to recover. Yeah, just get over it, yeah. Yeah. It's those kind of, you know, encouragers. You said those kind of resourceful people around you that cause burnout. And, but. Oh, yeah. So, but I think those are things, you know, there are things like that that are just hard. You know, doing good. And you know, everybody would have some of those classic examples if you kind of went to, you know, the all-time, for me, you know, the all-time most clearest example was this, and I still know the lady's name, Mrs. Allsgood. An interesting name. Yeah, an interesting name with this lady, too, you know. Should have been, you know, always bad or something. But she had, you know, and this was early, you know, my life as a pastor in the, you know, early, you know, first 4 or 5 years or something. And, but she had, you know, one of these horrific lives. I mean, she'd had so much go wrong. You know, her fiance was hit by a car when he was walking to the church on their day of marriage, to get married. He was hit by a car. You know, and he was hurt badly, and I don't know exactly, wasn't a totally invalid, but had all kinds of problems, and they went ahead and got married. But I mean, that was just one of the things. And this lady was confined to bed. And we were a small church, so by the time we became aware of her, you know, she'd gone through probably every church in Brenham. And so, you know, people in our church, you know, you did stuff, you go over and minister to her. And I remember, you know, but everybody, after a while, you stop. She wouldn't let you. She'd just drive you away. And I remember one time you ever seen these little wooden reindeers at Christmas? They're kind of put together. You know, they just got like a piece and they just kind of, it's like a little puzzle, but it's like three little cutout pieces and you stick them together. Well, Megan was a year and a half when we moved there, so Megan's, you know, younger probably than Eric and Annie, but, you know, no older than that, and probably younger than that, and we're over there, and she's insisting that Megan take one of those. I mean, you know, it's like, it's easier to take it than to keep saying no and all that. It just keeps on and on and on. And then the next time you go, the accusation that you stole it. And then that somebody brought a pie. I remember this one. This was one of the last times I was there. That somebody had brought a pie. And anyway, this pie had set out. And it was something that needs to be in the refrigerator. I think it was a pie. But anyway, it was rot. And it wasn't even possible that they'd left it out accidentally. It was intentional. They just brought it over there and left it out intentional, just so it ruined. And she was so angry. And it was just that kind of stuff over all the time. And you know, she just kept on until people couldn't do it anymore. You know, they grew weary of doing good, as far as she was concerned. And, you know, went through church after church after, you know, kind people after kind people. But it goes,
should people have stopped?
I don't know. I mean, you know, should you keep on? Yeah, I would think you should. Though, I mean, there's a place where, I don't know, you can get into all this stuff about enabling, you know, apart from that. But as far as just the goodness, yeah, you ought to keep on. But, you know, there's a part where, you know, you're not necessarily stopping doing good for people. But as far as that person, when they just, you know, always attacking you and accusing you of things, it's hard. But that's with hers when I came to realization at that time in my life, was that, because she had, like I said, there were just all kinds of problems. She was such a bitter lady, and you could say, well, I understand why. Look at all these things that's happened in her life. And at the same time, I knew some people that had equally bad things, and they were very joyful. And I realized, you know, your choices in life, you become one or the other. And with like people that are really joyful, that, you know, older people, you know, like those that are 3 or 4 years older than me, you know, some phrases just, as soon as you say it, you're kind of like, I can't say that anymore. But they're real joyful. And you say, oh, that's what I want to be like, you know, when I grow up. And I started realizing your choices now, you know, you go in one of those two directions. And there's probably extremes. There's probably people, you know, in the middle. But the really joyful people and the really bitter people have a lot of similar issues in life. It's just how do you respond?
We have some people we know who are missionaries, and the wife has just co-authored a book about burnout in missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is something about expectations and how the expectations that are placed on, it's particularly regarding women in missions, the expectations play a lot into, you know, what our own expectations are and whether we meet those and take on things we shouldn't be. And I haven't read it, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, this, you know, and this is one of the, you know, one of the things about hiring, you know, pastors or something, that there's just no, probably no perfect, you know, or even good way to go about it all. But, you know, in South Dakota, I mean, you know, everybody we met with that's in the, quote, official capacity that you're, you know, making the decisions, whether it was the, you know, the search committee team or the elder board or the deacon board, you know, you're asking, well, what's, you know, what are the expectations of Robin and so forth? And, it, you know, everybody was just be your wife, you know, it's just there are no expectations, Sean. And then we've been there, you know, the first month, and they have their, you know, monthly or ladies, big ladies meeting that they have. And, you know, and of course, you know, it's for Robin's first time there. And so there's just, you know, introducing Robin and so forth. And this lady gets up and reads this thing that she got from some book, you know, but she's reading it, and it's just this, you know, it's this long list of, you know, of expectations of a pastor's wife. All these things that we know you'll do. And, you know, you had some people coming up and apologizing and all that, but it was, you know, overwhelming, you know.
So did it never enter your mind to acquire a large caliber revolver?
Yeah. You know, and so.
If pastors can keep a rifle and a revolver in the pulpit, can
they? Yep, it's the law.
Well, I think.
Wonder if they have a higher per capita pastors.
Well, then after this, he moves in instruction concerning the disobedient. And, you know, there is a real possibility, he's saying here, that some are not going to follow these instructions. And I think this is more, you know, it's things related to this letter. You know, because previously he had been there and he had taught them, and then some people come in and disrupt things, and he writes. And so there's a real possibility that some aren't going to follow these things. And so, the path that the congregation should follow is outlined also. Verse 14, if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter. So by application, we could, you know, say if you don't obey the Bible, but specifically this one is talking about the directives in this letter. So just to back up, well, you got directives about those that don't work. But you also have stuff about, the day of the Lord, you know, these kind of teaching. You know, the first thing you're supposed to do is take special note of that person. So, you know, there's an identifying those that are disruptive. And secondly, you don't associate with them. And the purpose is that they would be put to shame. There's this that they would feel, that the idea is not so much, we can talk about shame, and shame's probably a pretty strong negative term in our society. You should never make anybody feel shame, that would be our society, I would imagine. The idea here is that, they would feel shame. They would feel, recognize, this almost a sense of guilt. When I was reading this afternoon, thought came to mind about the that Christmas movie, The Christmas Story. And in that, there's this something the class does. I can't remember which one it was. Yeah, it could have been with the pole. It could have been when they all had their little things, but it's the teacher chides them and talks about how badly they feel or something. Yes. And they're all like, and then the little narrator goes, adults love to do that, but we know it's much better to get away with it than to get caught, basically. So they're all like, oh, we feel so bad. Yeah, they don't feel bad at all. But here, so it's this sense of, that they would, there's a part here, yeah, you would feel something, you would change, is the idea. That they would respond. But while you're not associating with them, in verse 15 it says, but don't regard them as an enemy, but you're admonishing as a brother. And that's this whole thing of not church discipline or here, or it doesn't, follow. Once again, it doesn't really follow the Matthew description of church discipline, but this is this seems to, once again, this isn't somebody knows something. This is already publicly known. It's not like I saw what you did, or you saw me do this, and or you know of this habitual pattern in my life. But this is seems to be, things that are known. But the admonishing is as a brother. I care about you, and not as an enemy. I've often felt like in Christian circles that, and there is clearly biblically a place for confrontation, and it's almost as though the rule should be, if confrontation comes easy to you, then don't do it. You're not the one that should be doing it. Because those almost that I've observed, it's almost that they regard people as enemies. That's what they end up making people. And not, it doesn't come across as love. I've seen people, and one of the things that I observed with this was that a person in a church in Brenham was would confront people quite often and was always correct. I mean, in the technical sense, always correct. But it really didn't matter. I mean, the issues really weren't that big. But that makes it hard when you're right. It makes it hard when they're correct, technically, because it's just much harder to deal with. We don't have them, but let's say if we, one of the things there's, we had song sheets. Somebody was taking a song sheet. Well, you have to reproduce those song sheets to have enough for everybody. If you take song sheets, then, somebody may have to make some more. We may not have enough. So, technically, you could say, unless somebody's made an announcement, these are free. Yeah, if you Dave's taking a song sheet, and I go, Dave, don't take that song sheet. We need those song sheets. I'd be technically correct because, yeah, you shouldn't take them. And so it makes it hard to go, Randy, you really shouldn't do that. But it's like, why? So somebody's going to have to go reproduce a few extra song sheets. This was important to this person for some reason. I mean, now they're just sticking it in their Bible because they forgot, or you know, they just throw it away. That's another issue. But if somebody's going like, oh yeah, I really like this song, I'm going to take these home and sing them this week. Yeah, but see, and it's those kind of it's that type of thing. It's those kind of confrontations are hard because see, you're not really seeing the person as a brother. You're almost seeing them as an enemy. You're seeing this as an issue of right, wrong. And I'm, in this moment, I'm the song sheet police. And I'm right, and relationship doesn't matter. And I think that's what you're, you know, here, is relationship matters. You know.
When you put yourself in a position, you're really saying, I have authority over you, and you are my underling.
And which is a real issue in things like that, is like, why do you who appointed you to be the song sheet police, you know, or the whatever. But I think, you know, those same kinds of people often break all kinds of rules, but it's different when they do it because it's for some other reason. But I think that, you know, the goal here is that, you know, it's not to confront here. I mean, we're told, you know, don't associate, you know. But yet, even the not associating, we realize that it's not like an absolute, you just never, okay, I saw you, I'm not talking to you anymore, because he's talking about admonishing. There's something here, but it's with the whole goal of winning somebody back, not of like that, I'm going to correct a problem. You know, we don't want to have song sheets gone, we don't want to have this. And, you know, which people get their feelings hurt, people leave, whatever, you know. Here is the whole idea, is that restoring brothers, and which is the whole goal in, you know, Matthew 18 passage. It's always about winning people back. Well, then he moves into some very final things, the concluding prayer. Verse 16 says, now may the Lord of peace himself continually grant you peace in every circumstance. The Lord be with you all. Well, the God of peace is mentioned in Romans 15:33 and 16:20. So at the end of Romans, it talks about the God of peace. Also, at the end of 2 Corinthians 13:11, the end of Philippians 4:9, and the end of 1 Thessalonians 5:23, all makes a reference to the God of peace. But here, it's the Lord of peace. So, somewhat synonymous. As opposed to the Father, viewing the Father, you know, here's Christ. And we just see, you know, so often in Scripture where these kinds of things overlap. But he is the possessor of peace. He's the one that peace flows from. And may he grant peace. You know, he is peace. Is the source of peace and may grant peace. And you know, there's peace with God that we have through salvation. So it's not talking about that. But this is, you know, the peace of God, knowing this tranquility, this wholesomeness. And that's what would be in view here, so that one would have that in every circumstance. And then Paul gives his authoritative signature here, you know, which is really important in this passage, this idea of, you know, something that authenticates this is Paul, because one of the things has happened, that there have been letters that have been passed around that have been misrepresenting Paul. So here he says, which is an indication that, you know, as we see that Paul's dictating his letters, but here he actually, you know, writes this, you know, I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand, and this is my distinguishing mark in every letter. This is the way I write. So I'm not really sure, you know, how that worked. I mean, how many letters did they have of Paul? To, you know, if they still had 1 Thessalonians around, did they have his signature? Did they still have, you know? It's not, you know, there surely wasn't lots of things around with handwriting, so I'm not exactly sure. But it does offer it in terms of, you know, maybe even if you don't recognize it right now, it can be authenticated. You know, he's, you know, that's its purpose here. And then the concluding benediction here, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. And this whole idea of, you know, grace, you know, the grace of Christ, grace of the Lord being with others is a very common in his concluding letters. You know, it includes Romans and 1 Thessalonians in very similar ways.
So would he be saying that's how he signs it, by ending it that way?
No, I think the actual verse that he wrote, I think that was his, and then he just concluded this. I would assume that verse 18 would have been, had also been in his handwriting by the very nature of it. But I think verse 17 is the you know, is his greeting. And it may, you know, perhaps, you know, 16, 17, and 18 were all in his handwriting. You know, I really don't know. We don't have that. But, you know, he ends 1 Thessalonians, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. I mean, those are just, you know, something like that is the way a lot of the letters end. Well, questions or thoughts, insights on this passage or anything in the book?
Because, you know, Paul would send a letter someplace and then it would be copied and distributed elsewhere. You know, that was often how these got around and were mm-hmm. referenced in Scripture. But, you know, as they were copying it, they also copied this. This is done in my own handwriting,
yeah.
You know, which it's not at that point.
Well, and the early letters, you know, I mean, real early, they were. I think the letter itself would have been circulated, not copies. But then, obviously, you know, at some later time, we got into the, as you're saying, the copying of letters, which would, yeah. So, you know, because we don't have any. We don't have any manuscripts that anybody is maintaining is an original. You know, they're all, you know, everything's a copy. And so that's.
Was Paul's authority as an apostle ever questioned in this book?
Not in this one. Just that other people were giving out information and
like people were using that.
Like in his name, it seems, you know, like wrote a letter in his name. That seems to be the implication.
So what were the themes that he touched on in this book?
Well, the major thing is the day of the Lord. I mean, that's, right. And it's in the center though, so it, and it's not that long.
Right.
I mean, the whole letter is not that long, but.
And then the problem with people not working.
You know, if you look at,
yeah.
You know, you have the chapter 1 is, you know, this Thanksgiving. We have to always give thanks. And, you know, encouragement to them in the midst of persecution. So it's, you know.
I have
promises of deliverance on the side there too. Yeah. Kind of, you know, he says in verse 5, this is a plain indication of God's righteous judgment. I mean, you know, there's persecutions going on, and so it's encouragement in the midst of those. And which persecutions would, I assume that would be reasons that people would be saying, oh, the day of the Lord's there. So those seem to be, you know, maybe related. And then chapter 2 is basically about the day of the Lord. And then chapter 3 is this laundry list of things where, you know, ask them to pray about them. But mainly is saying these people that aren't working should be working. Well, he's saying, I guess you go technically. I mean, you go through and come up with any of the directives. But I would think the main thing would be like in verse 3, let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostate comes first. So I think the people that continue to promote a contrary teaching, I would think that's the main thing.
A contrary teaching to what he's teaching
here. Yeah. That's what I would think is the main thing. I mean, there are other directives, such as the, you know, working, and but he's already addressed what to do with them. You know, he already said that. So I think it's... But, I mean, even the encouragement that comes in chapter 1, you know, has to do with this idea that we're, you know, this persecution and, you know, the Lord returns. So if you, you know, a misusing of that. So I think that's more, the more focus seems to be on, in, you know, chapter 2. That seems to be the real focus of the letter. The first part, chapter 1, kind of builds up to it. And peripheral things, and then chapter 3 kind of moves away from it with some peripheral things. And chapter 2 is the, seems to be the real issue.